720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Kind of a foggy and gray day out there, but I hope that you are enjoying this sort of a little bit warmer weather than we're used to this time of year. We will take it, right? We will take it, because this time last year, I think on this day last year, it was zero, if records are to be believed. So we'll take 50 over zero any old day. All right, my friends, today on the Wintrust Business Lunch, we've got lots to do and lots to talk about. We are going to be talking about Chipotle, because, you know, Chipotle's been in the news a little bit lately, and they've got some headaches going. So we're going to be talking about that. We're also going to be talking with a company called Buddy Truck. It's a really interesting idea. It's kind of this, in the on-demand economy that we're in. Think sort of Uber for moving. Where was this past week when I was moving, right? So we're going to be talking with them, and we're going to be talking about Dan Price. He's the CEO of a company called Gravity. And speaking of headaches, he's got a few of them too. So we're going to be talking about that. But before we do that, we welcome to the show Adam Kennedy, local Chicago entrepreneur. Hi, Adam. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Gladly. Glad you're here today with us on a Saturday. So you are the co-founder of a company called Salt. And this is such an interesting thing. And I can't say I've ever seen anything like this. So I wanted to talk to you so much. And so essentially, you know, as we've been talking so much about gun violence and guns this and guns that, mm-hmm. and I mean, I think there has not been an hour of programming on this show, or on this station rather, certainly not in the last few weeks, without talking about guns on some level. And that's something on your mind. But you've made a company that's doing what you're calling a non-lethal alternative to that. So talk to us a bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, really similarly, I think, to so many people right now, we are actually a Humboldt-based company. And we kind of got our start. I moved to Chicago and moved into Humboldt. And that first week that I moved in, a young man was shot to death in mm-hmm. the street in front of my house. And I think that was a really personal kind of experience of kind of what the whole country is kind of looking at with gun violence right now. And I think one of the things me and the other co-founder, who's actually my neighbor, sat down, and instead of just kind of going out and saying, hey, let's, you know, no one should have guns, which doesn't really seem to be that effective. Both of us kind of come from a product background. So we kind of asked ourselves if technology could actually help us alleviate a lot of this. So about 70% of all guns in the U.S. are bought for home protection. So, but no one's ever kind of redesigned them specifically for a home. So we kind of got a whiteboard and wrote two of the three major things that we would engineer out of a gun in order to make it safe for a home. And we kind of look at safety in two ways. One, can it keep you safe from an intruder coming in your house? But can it also keep you safe from the accidents that kind of all too often accompany a firearm in a home? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what we set out to do. And we started doing that by first redesigning the bullet. So instead of lead, we made Salt to shoot kind of a form of powdered pepper spray. And it's in kind of encapsulated in kind of a plastic projectile, so that you've got way more distance in between, just like 6 feet from you to somebody with like a traditional pepper spray. So what we ended up with was kind of a gun that you can use for offense or defense. You can, someone breaks in your house, you don't have to go and shoot them. You can shoot the stairs, and that's what happens at our house. If our alarm goes off, we would go and shoot the stairs and then go call 911. And no one could kind of come through that cloud. But if you had to, you could also actually shoot a person coming in. And that cloud, kind of a lot like pepper spray or tear gas, makes it really hard for you to see and kind of breathe, kind of incapacitates the person. Great news on the other side is if your son or your daughter found it and shot themselves, they would be extremely unhappy that they did that, but they would not die. from it. So,
this bullet that you've sort of re-engineered to be filled with essentially a proprietary blend of something like pepper spray or tear gas. What happens on contact? If you have an intruder and you shoot this re-engineered bullet at that person, what happens when that hits them?
So it hits them, and we kind of engineered the shell itself to kind of fling itself open, but the plastic itself somewhat vaporizes, it disintegrates. And I think probably the best way to think about it, it's about the consistency of baby powder, the actual chemical agent. And it kind of puffs up in the air. About each bullet can cover about 5 feet of space in your home. And as it hits, it kind of releases into the air. And if it contacts your eyes, you can't see. And then different than pepper spray, you can actually inhale it. And it's basically like a controlled asthma attack, that it constricts all the lungs. We use natural ghost pepper extract, and that's actually what constricts the lungs. But
how fast is that?
15 minutes, it's better.
Okay, and 15 minutes, theoretically, you could get away or get the cops there or whatever. How fast is that cartridge coming at the person? Is it enough to make, is it going to pierce the skin?
No, it doesn't. From very, very close ranges, it causes very, very bad bruising. It travels about 320 feet per second, so the kinetic energy of it is about like being hit with a fastball, going about 50 miles an hour in the chest. So there's quite a bit of kinetic energy, but we've engineered it to be fairly wide. So it actually has quite a bit of mass to it. Mm-hmm. So it actually can't pierce the skin.
I see. Okay. So, I mean, I have to ask, we have to consider, while it's all fair and good, if someone wants to defend their own home, everyone has the right to think through how that works for them and what's right in their lives for that. But where we often run into issues in this world is when things are used not for home protection, but they're used out in the world against other people.
Yeah.
So what happens if someone, say, fires this on a bus? Because if it seems like you could incapacitate a lot of people really quickly. What about that
for
kind
sure.
of stuff?
We actually kind of run across this question quite a bit, and I actually think that will be one of my most proud days in our company's lifespan, because if I think about it now, sure, you could still go in and shoot a school with this gun, but everyone lives to walk away. So different than what we see at something like Columbine or something like that kid's going to be in trouble that did that. And yes, that's really inconvenient for everyone and kind of terrible. But at the same time, everyone gets to wake up the next morning with their kids at home. Mm-hmm. And I think that is kind of the bigger conversation of when we take the lethality of firearms out of our home, do we also really begin to take them out of even things like suicides or domestic violence and things like that? Do we reduce the number of very violent, very permanent interactions like that?
So I want to talk about Indiegogo briefly, too, because you went to fund $75,000 on Indiegogo crowdfunding platform, and crowdfunding is something we've talked a lot about on this show. But this is a new one for me, and that Indiegogo pulled your campaign within about a day. Talk about that.
It was a new one for me as well. So we went on to Indiegogo to raise the insurance to ship, where we're actually all the products are completely done now, and we just needed to get the insurance to actually ship those out. So we went up on Indiegogo, and that day, there was a anti-gun Twitter personality out of San Francisco that got a very large amount of his following to email Indiegogo all at once. So about 40,000 emails kind of poured into Indy at once. And so they took us down. Truthfully, we never talked to them. They never called us.
But they do have something in their you know, in their site that says, you know, it's against the rules to make any kind of weapon, and they were calling this a weapon, essentially.
Yes. So we had talked to them before, and Indiegogo has completely run flamethrowers and dart guns and things. So together we had decided that we fell well within their parameters of discussing that, of kind of meeting that criteria. However, 40,000 emails can be quite
persuasive
for a company. And, you know, one of the things that I love about what we're doing is both a good and bad, or a positive and a negative. There's a lot of people really passionate about this, about keeping people safe and things like that. So while I wish that would not have happened, I think us and that entire group were really working for the same goal. And so I think we got kind of our wires crossed a little bit in that.
Well, and it seems interesting because it seems like what's provocative to people and upsetting, it seems like it's the shape, right? Because, it's like the shape and the delivery method, because we're not, I know people that have bear mace and things like that for home protection, and have, you know, pepper spray and all those kind of things that you have. I mean, I know people that keep like baseball bats and nine irons in their house, you know, things like that. But it seems like it's, I mean, if you go to saltsupply.com, it's a pretty serious looking thing. If I had that pointed at me, I would back up. I would definitely say, okay, something's up here. So it seems like it's maybe the delivery method that is so provocative, but it is a really interesting thing that you're doing. And I appreciate you joining us today. People can go to saltsupply.com. And where can people find you on social media, Adam?
We're at LinkedIn Twitter at Salt Supply, and Facebook at Salt Supply as well.
All right. Well, thanks so much, and good luck with all that you're doing. And we hope to talk to you again on the program.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thanks so much. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch with you till 1 o'clock. Hope you're enjoying the day. It's not sunny out, but it's sure warmer than it was this time last year. So let's soak it in while we can, because I'm sure January will bring a very different story for us. All right, my friends, we still have so much to talk about here today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. But right now, I want to talk about Chipotle, because Chipotle has been in the news an awful lot lately. And joining us now is our friend Roberto Ferdman from Washington Post. Hi, Roberto. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Certainly. Well, the headline on your one of your most recent stories, I'm going to turn it right back to you, and that is, what in the world is happening to Chipotle?
So Chipotle is experiencing kind of what I call the perils of scaling a business that is not that easy to scale. They base their business model, or at least a huge part of their pitch, on serving food that people should be proud of, and that means many different things. But part of it means that they serve a certain quality of food. And as you grow, the market doesn't necessarily keep up with you. That's to say, the food system that supplies the food that they're serving to people. So we saw earlier this year that they had to stop serving pork at something like 600 stores because one of their main suppliers had breached their standards. And it took a long time to get that back. And now we see that they're having trouble with food safety. So over the past essentially 2 weeks, it's really ramped up. But over the past 2 months now, Chipotle has been dealing with an E. coli outbreak that has tainted their reputation.
And what was so interesting is I thought, you know, the situation with pork almost ended up being like a blessing in disguise to them. It ended up being kind of like a PR thing, because it made them trust Chipotle more. They were saying, oh, carnitas are back, and it was such a big deal. I mean, I remember seeing that on social media. People were excited when their local Chipotle got that product back, and they kind of inspired even more trust to Chipotle, that look at them, they're looking out for us, they're doing all this stuff, and then to suddenly turn around and have this E. coli outbreak. But I think what made it worse is it seems like there was a relatively small outbreak that was fairly contained, and they were quite proactive about it. And then it suddenly was much bigger than what they thought.
Part of this is Chipotle trying to manage the reaction to the original news, which essentially started in the Pacific Northwest. You know, they told people that we're closing 43 stores out of precaution because only 6 were linked to the E. coli outbreak. Mm-hmm. But right, you're right to point out that it kind of avalanched into something much worse. That's not to say that these happened in the aftermath. Actually, the outbreak that touched restaurants in Chicago and Maryland and elsewhere in the country was actually linked to that same exact problem. So it happened early in November, late October. But exactly, you're right. It's a lot worse than they made it seem at first. And the reaction, which we've seen anecdotally, you know, I went to stores in New York to go talk to the managers, talk to people there. And we had someone go to somewhere in D.C. And neither of these places were affected by the outbreak. And yet both of them reported significant reduction in traffic, which mm-hmm. said that people don't feel so great about eating at Chipotle right now because they've seen what's in the news.
Right. And we saw this with Taco Bell just a few years ago in 2006, I guess it was, when Taco Bell had that E. coli thing that was lettuce that was in the Northeast area. You know, that one, I think it took them 5 quarters to recover.
They suffered mightily in the aftermath of that. And there's reason to believe that Chipotle might suffer just as much, if not more, because Taco Bell doesn't. Part of Taco Bell's pitch isn't this mission to serve food with integrity. And as soon as people start to question that, it might compromise their decision to go and spend a little bit more money at your establishment. But I talked to a few people who kind of look closely at how companies recover from crises, especially in the food industry. And what they said is essentially people are willing to forgive one-off offenses. So if Chipotle doesn't have another problem with food safety, they'll probably be all right. It might take a little bit. It might not be until mid-next year that people feel just as comfortable as they did before. But if they are a repeat offender, if they have another problem with food safety, that might tarnish their reputation for a much longer time.
Right. And I was thinking about this for a couple of reasons. Not only do we have their kind of delving into the area of Asian food a little bit with Shop House that's just opened here in the Loop of Chicago. And so it seems, you know, the timing could not be worse for them. But then also, you know, I was thinking, you know, about other companies that have recovered from this, you know, of course, Taco Bell, but then also Jack in the Box in about, you know, sometime in the early 90s when, you know, there was that big outbreak and I think a couple of children died as a result of foodborne illness. But that ended up bringing, you know, Jack in the Box led such a big charge with the Clinton administration at that time to make things safer. So they ended up kind of, I think, getting public trust back by going and being the you know, kind of the leaders of that conversation in a way. So it'll be interesting to see the next move from Chipotle, not only as they're going into this kind of new endeavor area, but then also how they recover if they you know, become kind of thought leaders in the area or if they just try to let it blow over or what. Any indication of where you think that's going?
Well, Chipotle has pledged to do exactly what you're saying. They're about to implement a robust change in the way in which they oversee their food safety at their various establishments. And it starts with how they deal with their suppliers. They're requiring that all food that comes in and is served at all of their restaurants is tested before arriving for pathogens, which is pretty much unheard of. I think that this is something that the American populace isn't aware of. But chicken suppliers, for instance, don't have to test the chicken that they deliver raw to establishments before they arrive. And this is something that Chipotle is going to have to wrestle with because the expectation is that there'll be a little bit of resistance to this. It's expensive, it's kind of annoying, and they're not used to it. It's something that the government requires. Mm-hmm. On top of that, they're introducing pretty stringent rules when it comes to food safety at their establishment. So at the Boston restaurant where there was a norovirus outbreak, there were two violations. One was mishandling of poultry. The poultry was too cold for people to be handling it, which means you could transfer pathogens from the chicken to other produce. And the other, which is kind of more serious in many ways, is that a sick employee was working at the restaurant, which is to say they could have brought norovirus there and then spread it to the over 100 people that are believed to have been sickened.
Wow.
So
yeah.
They have pledged to be thought leaders and action leaders when it comes to food safety, but it kind of remains to be seen whether they will actually change the way in which the industry acts. But there's reason to believe they might, because in many ways they have pushed the industry along in several ways, especially with respect to animal welfare and sustainability.
Definitely.
And in ways that we might not have pictured.
Yeah, I think they've really kind of driven that conversation a lot and had it brought into a lot more mainstream way. So it'll be interesting to see how they recover and what they do. But thank you so much for joining us today, Roberto Ferdman from Washington Post. Have a great Saturday.
You too. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. All right, my friends, we're going to take a quick break and get you to news. But when we come back, we're talking about Buddy Truck. It's like Uber for moving. It'll change your life, I bet. We're going to talk all about it on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, it's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking about Gravity Payments. You've probably heard a little bit about their CEO, Dan Price. got some issues of his own going on right now, so we're going to be talking with him. But right now, we are talking about something totally different, and that is, I don't know about you, but man, I do not like moving. Moving is no fun at all. Nothing fun about it. But there is a company right here in Chicago that's trying to make it a lot more pleasant. Please welcome Aaron Eggleston of Buddy Truck to the show. Hi, Aaron. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me, Amy.
Glad to have you. I wish I knew about you a week ago. I just moved. And I, as soon as I read about this, I thought, oh, my God. Of course, now I hear about it. But essentially, this is like the idea of like Uber for moving. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Buddy Truck came about. Our CEO, Brian Foley, was moving, and he probably had an experience similar to yours, you know, rented a truck and had a bad experience backing into his new roommate's car. Just couldn't help but think that there's got to be a better way to do this. You know, why isn't there a company that provides a buddy with a truck? And so thus Buddy Truck was born. We've been around for about 2 years, and we just launched in Chicago in early November.
I love that. Well, that's such a great idea because I think nobody wants to get that call, right? Hey, buddy, we help me move. No one wants that call.
Go ahead. I was going to say we hire a lot of drivers who've never done anything like this before. So there are a lot of guys with trucks. We have ladies as well with large vehicles and trucks also that we're hiring. And you know, instead of everybody always coming to you and asking you and taking advantage of you, drivers can come and work for us and make some money moving people at an affordable price. It also provides a lot of convenience.
Right, where you can actually make money instead of getting paid in pizza and beer, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and so tell us about how does the insurance part work? Because I think that's where it gets a little hairy for me, you know, and I think we've been talking about that a lot with Uber versus cabs and things like that. And so how does it work for Buddy Truck?
So Buddy Truck covers all the items that we carry, any items that we're picking up, delivering, and we also cover our buddies and their trucks. We make sure that we have a really great insurance policy that takes care of anything that may happen when our buddies are out on the road.
Okay.
And also moving things in and out. So if you ding a wall or, you know, anything like that, that's also covered as well.
So they'll not only help you drive your stuff to your new place, but they will help you schlep it inside.
They certainly will.
That is dynamite. I love that. And so what kind of costs are we looking at for this, for the average in-town move?
Yeah. So the average, well, our delivery service works that it's $1 a minute plus $1 a mile. So any delivery is both change in price determined, you know, depending on how far you're going. The average delivery in Chicago right now is about 9 miles in 45 minutes, and that comes in at about $60. But most delivery services, if you're going that far for that amount of time, it's going to be closer to $100. So we're trying to make sure that it's an affordable price for everyone.
Indeed. And that's a very affordable price point. And so what about, you know, you have some competition in this area. We've been seeing things from Dolly, but then also Zipcar has the Zip Van. Tell us about some of those differences there.
Yeah, so our pricing is very simple. It's always $1 a mile plus $1 a minute. So you don't have to worry about not knowing whether or not your mattress is going to cost you $50 or $100. It's going to be determined by the length of your move. Another thing is that, you know, we're an on-demand service. You call us when you need us. So as soon as you're ready to move and you've got all your stuff waiting for us, you download the app, put in your destination and where you want to go, and we'll be there within an hour, and we'll have everything moved for you. So we match our drivers within 10 minutes. Guaranteed. So there's really not a lot of waiting around, and there's not a lot of scheduling in advance. It's all when you need it and we're ready to go.
Now, I know a thing that comes up a lot with Uber is that surge pricing during peak times. Do you have different so if I were to move on, say, a Monday, would it be a lot different price than if I were to move on, say, a Saturday morning when a lot of people are probably moving?
Right. You know, we don't do surge pricing. The only thing that I would be concerned about is traffic. You know, the longer that our buddies have to drive in traffic to get to where they're going, the higher the price is going to be. But Buddy Truck doesn't charge any type of surge pricing. It's always $1 a minute plus $1 a mile. So as long as we can get from point A to point B, that's how long it's going to take, and that'll be the cost that we'll pay.
Well, it's such an interesting idea. I love all the things people are coming up with in this space of delivery, whether it's, you know, getting a Starbucks delivered, you know, just as a one-off, which has come a long way from, you know, calling a restaurant and having delivery with a minimum order, you know, to Uber, to Lyft, to, you know, all of the things people are coming up with in this space. And I think this is a really, really affordable one. So I wish you the best of luck. It seems like it's a great price point. It's a great service. And so it'll be great to see how everything goes. And I hope it goes wonderfully for you all here in Chicago.
Well, thank you so much.
And
I'm
so
sorry we couldn't be there for you sooner.
I know. I wish I would have met you a few weeks ago. But nonetheless, if people are about to move and want to, or just move something and are looking for your services, how can they contact you?
So they can download our app in both the Google Play Store or in the Apple iPhone, you know, the, what is it called? iTunes Store.
Right.
And then if they want to reach out to us via phone, they can also do that as well. And it's available on our website, which is buddytruck.com.
Excellent. Well, so this is a great thing, you guys, because that way you don't have to have that awkward conversation with friends. You can just rent a friend that is totally on board with helping you move. So, Erin Eggleston, thanks so much for being with us. Everybody, head to buddytruck.com for more information about that. Erin, have a great Saturday.
Thank you. You as well. Bye-bye.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're talking about a company called Gravity Payments and some woes they are facing right now that we're going to talk all about here in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us. With you a little bit longer. At 1 o'clock, we'll turn things over to King John. It'll be all good. So, my friends, I want to talk about, you've probably heard about this company called Gravity Payments. Maybe you have. I hope you have. There's a really interesting thing going on there, really. They launched and they made headlines in back in April because they said, you know what, we're going to pay everybody the starting salary of $70,000. And it was such a big deal. But then the ball of twine started to unravel a little bit. And now their CEO, Dan Price, is in a little bit of a scandal. And so here to talk with us about that is Karen Wise from Bloomberg Businessweek. Hi, Karen. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Glad you could join us today. Thanks for taking the time on a Saturday. So kind of talk us through this because it's such a fascinating story. I mean, this guy, you know, their CEO was suddenly at one point being called the Robin Hood. And it was really this, you know, so many people were looking to him in the tech space as being such an innovator for paying people a much higher starting salary and really addressing a lot of inequities in the workplace. But then suddenly things started to unravel. So take us through that a bit.
Sure. Yeah. So in mid-April, Dan Price announced kind of with the New York Times and NBC News present to his staff that he was going to raise the minimum pay at his company to $70,000. And it became this kind of overnight sensation of a story. He did, you know, 24 TV interviews over the next couple of days. He was headlined all over the world. It was kind of this like big grand gesture about inequality in the country. And
he even was saying that he was going to take part of his own salary to cover the cost of the adjustment of this.
Exactly. So he said he was taking his salary down from about a little over $1 million to $70,000 as well. So you had all these headlines about this 90% pay cut that he was taking, which is obviously quite dramatic and moving in many ways. And he, over the following months, became this kind of sensation and was, you know, got a speaking agent, got a book deal. He spoke all over the world and has been on magazine covers and all sorts of things like that. And then in July, there was a follow-up article in the New York Times, pretty long one, looking at some of the kind of difficulties it caused for the company. A couple of employees left saying that they thought it was kind of messing with the workplace, and some customers left, so they say far more customers have joined since kind of in support of this mission that they have.
And the people that left, it seemed like their complaint was that raising everyone to 70,000 kind of undermined the value of some higher paid employees that were already making, you know, around the six figure mark.
That was how the New York Times reported it. Yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. And so then at some point we come to discover that his brother had started to sue him and all of these things were suddenly not quite as rosy as they seemed, even though he was painting a little bit different picture. The court records and the timeline on paper, they're not quite adding up with his story.
Exactly. So in a couple of articles in the Seattle Times and the New York Times, the lawsuit became public that his brother is the minority shareholder in the company. He has about 30% of the company. And the brother sued Dan for essentially excessive compensation, for enriching himself at the expense of the brother, who's the minority shareholder. Mm-hmm. And the way that Dan had kind of more or less insinuated that this went down and the way he talked to me about it was that it happened after the pay raise and that it was kind of a reaction to the pay raise. And it kind of fed into this underdog image that he had as really trying to prove this great thing right. And when I talked with him, for example, he told me that 2 weeks after he made this big pay announcement and was in New York and did all these TV interviews, and after all this kind of crazy media, he came back home and finally settling in and watching a soccer game for the first time when he was served with this lawsuit. And it was a very powerful moment. I asked him if he thought they were connected, and he said, you know, the only thing I know with my brother's suit was connected comes from this quote in the Seattle Times that kind of to me implies that it is, but that's the only thing I know. But then when I sat down to write my story, I looked at the court records and the court documents and saw that actually the lawsuit came a month before the pay raise and before all the times that he's talked about having come up with the idea in the first place. And so what you have now instead is his brother suing him essentially for being greedy, and then a month later he does this kind of glorious act that literally gets him compared to Jesus in many places, including on the Today Show.
Right.
On the Daily Show, excuse me. So it just complicates what he had set out as pretty pure motivation.
Right. I remember that. It was, I think it was actor Russell Brand, right, that said it's hard to ignore the fact that the guy looks like Jesus. And indeed, that's kind of how, I mean, people were really giving this guy so much credit as this big game changer. I think I said somebody had compared him to Robin Hood, and he was really just going to, change so much in the tech space, which I think is attractive right now because we talk about that so much, you know, with Twitter coming out saying we have all these inequities in our workplace and we're going to fix it. Hold us to it in 2016, where we have, you know, where we have a big conversation about pay disparity happening, not just in the tech sector, but in a lot of places. You know, suddenly he was kind of this shining star. And I think what's interesting is I think people people almost like to watch, you know, the celebrity train wreck. But I think certainly in the fall from grace in this too, people were just kind of stunned and betrayed, but also a little, you know, couldn't look away from this as things sort of started to unravel a little bit. So mm-hmm. what's the state of things right now for Gravity?
Yeah, right now, I haven't heard from them since the story came out. They've kind of denied the allegations and the story in general and said my story was baseless. And that's all I know right now. I haven't heard of anything else since. So we'll see if they'll continue getting media attention and things like that, or if they'll just keep going back to their business as it was prior, you know, managing credit card payments for different vendors. I don't know yet how this will play out kind of going forward. There was so much attention and it was becoming a huge focus of the business. On one hand, they serve small business clients, and they have a staff that's very dedicated to working with their customers. Mm-hmm. But they definitely, you know, they grew their marketing department a lot. It was bringing in new business, so it was a big part of the overall vision of the company. And Dan was very forthright in saying that he was going to use the publicity from this as much as he could to drive business and talk about what he said was the problems in the credit card processing industry.
Right,
he had told me that. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
He had said that he felt that he kind of didn't intend to become a leader of this movement, but that he felt a responsibility to be the best leader he could. And so I think that's part of what some people were reacting to, is he had kind of become this figurehead for some optimism that companies can do right. And but he kind of set himself up in many ways for some of this trouble because he was, you know, telling me and other reporters things that just didn't line up with public court records and other things like that.
Right.
I also found that his initial $1 million salary was very unusual for a company of Gravity size. They have about 120 employees. And there are a couple ways you can judge the revenue for a business of their size, but by either way that you judge the revenue or by the based on the number of employees, based on the other benchmark salary data, it would be very, very high, higher than the average top quartile of CEOs for companies that size.
Indeed.
So, again, continues to complicate the grandness of this gesture.
Right. And it is kind of hard to pull these two things apart. But really, if we take all the CEO stuff and set it aside of whether his timeline matches court records or not, and kind of just take all that aside and just look at the employee part. I mean, I think it is interesting. It is an interesting approach to a to a workplace, just because that is such a big deal, and we seem to not be making much progress in that way of kind of shoring up the inequities, particularly in that tech space. You know, if you take him mm-hmm. out of it, kind of what are your thoughts on just that one piece of it, of just the what this does for, you know, the message this sends for employees?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there was a lot of excitement, understandably so. You know, inequality is such a huge problem in our country. And here was someone doing something about it. And I think the kind of challenge that we have set up is that we have a system where you kind of require one magnanimous, generous CEO to act on it and hope that other people follow.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to keep watching this unfold and interesting to see if we, you know, how things turn out for him, but then also just how the effect of paying, employees, even as a starting salary, this higher amount, how that ripples out throughout other industries connected to it. Well, Karen Wise, thank you so much for being with us. We will keep track of everything you're writing about this and other things on Bloomberg. Thanks so much. Have a great Saturday. All right, so we will take a quick break and we will get you turned over to John Williams here in just a bit. But after we check in the news and all that, we'll be back here in just a second on 720 WGN.